and welcome to the CentralWork Script Club. I'm Patricia Milton, and in this episode, I'm speaking with Gary Graves about his world premiere play, Mandragola. We're joined by CentralWork's resident sound designer, Gregory Sharpen, who also engineers our podcast. You can read about Gary and Greg in our show notes.
Hi, Patricia.
Good evening.
And we're going to talk about the script of Mandragola and also about CentralWorks. So I'd like to start by asking Gary, who is the co-director of CentralWorks, along with Jan Zweifler, how did this come to be?
My involvement with CentralWorks goes back to, I think it was 1994. The company started in 1990. Soren Oliver was the first artistic director. And then I was invited to do a new play with CentralWorks in 95. And that was Andromache, my adaptation of the Racine classic, which we did at St. John's, the basement of St. John's Church up on College.
Wow.
Pretty much across the street from the Julia Morgan Theater. The company, like many nomad companies, theater companies back in the 1990s, Shotgun and Impact, all were madly searching for some space. And in 1997, Soren stepped out of the artistic direction, director position. And there was three of us. It was Jan and Deb Fink and myself and a small circle of associates of the company, members of the company. And the three of us kind of split the artistic direction title and responsibilities, Jan and Deb and I. Deb, of course, is still in our board of directors. And I think it was in 1998, Deb moved on to the board, and Jan and I decided to become co-directors of the company. We did a couple more shows before settling in at the City Club in 2002, I think. Yeah. In fact, Greg and I were just talking about that first season at this full season at the City Club last night, I think. And the first show we did at the City Club, we did actually a couple of shows before we became resident there. But in 2002, we settled in there. And the first show we did was Mata Hari. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, we've offered, that was our first three show season before the pandemic hit in 2020. We were doing four shows. We got up to four shows a year. Now we're back to three, and Jan and I have sort of run the company as business partners, sharing all the various administrative and production, a number of different production responsibilities, and then the artistic direction decisions we make together every year in the spring and summer for the following season.
Mm-hmm. And this is the 70th world premiere play for CentralWorks.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Woo! It was after we did our first collaboratively developed play in 1997, I think it was, which was also, that was one of the shows we did at the City Club. We did a new play called Rue that I directed and Samantha King wrote, and Gregory designed the sound, and Jan and Deb were the two actors in the play. It was a really tough developmental process. We'd never done it before, but it turned out to be a really exciting project. And we liked it so much, we said, let's just do all new plays from now on. And so ever since then, the company's been committed to doing all new plays. And as I mentioned, we'd done a couple before that are included in the figure of 70 that you that you mentioned, Patricia, but I guess it's taken us about 20 years to do 70 new plays, a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. So, Greg, how long have you been associated with the company?
I came in on what I guess was probably the second of the 70. I came in 1996 for a play that Gary wrote called The Golden Era.
Uh-huh.
And I was brought in not as a sound designer, but as a soundboard operator, Matt Spiro.
Yeah, that's right.
Matt Spiro, who in a way sort of mentored me on the general aesthetics of what sound design is, was the designer. And we were working with cassette decks back then. So I was like, throughout this entire play, I was sort of like swapping cassettes in and out of a cassette player.
Wow.
In full view of the audience, too. The soundboard was kind of in the middle of the audience, which is something else that Gary and I were talking about last night. But I had done video work for a play that Gary had done at UC Berkeley called Sarajevo. Mm-hmm. And I'd done the video design for that. And so I suspect that's why he asked me to come in and be the operator. And then after that, there was one other play that I was, quote, assistant sound designer, unquote. And then the next play was Rue, where I was the full sound designer. And I've designed all the plays since then.
I would just point out, Greg's done all the plays since then. He's been the sound designer on every show we've done since then.
Amazing.
I don't think any other artist could say that about all the shows we've done, including myself.
That's right, because there were a couple where you were.
Yeah.
Good Lord, that's frightening. Heavy responsibility lays on my shoulders there.
Well, you also contribute to the script dramaturgy and the development of the script, right? So you want to talk about your dual role there?
Well, it's a dual role that's not, it's not certainly mine uniquely. For people who maybe have listened to these podcasts before, know a little bit about the Central Works method or the developmental process, which is sort of has a couple of different kinds of iterations. There's like a full-on, like really intensive 10-week workshop or a 4-week workshop, or sometimes the play is just handed to us. But the workshops involve everybody getting together, the actors, the director, the writer, and me. As I think I'm been the only designer who's been involved in these workshops. But we all sort of, in a way, relinquish our roles and just become, as you say, we become dramaturgs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all in the service of helping the playwright listen to the play, get feedback, and kind of have an army of researchers at their disposal to kind of help craft the play. And that's one of the things that has kept me with the company, is that it's really exciting to have that kind of initial investment and also kind of a sense of ownership and a sense of being in the trenches from the very beginning. There's something very, very special about that. It means that by the time you actually come to the rehearsal process, I've already got sound ideas. The actors are already many, many steps ahead in terms of their knowledge of their character. And I think most of the feedback we've gotten from the playwrights is that it's kind of invaluable to have that kind of concentrated attention on the words of the play and on the play itself.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. You've made some key feedback. Given me some key feedback. I know, Greg.
I know I've also given you some irritating feedback. Like, what about
this?
It's
all right.
I hope you didn't. Right. I wanted people not to notice that.
So we're going to talk about Mondragola. In total, you've written 3 plays about Machiavelli. Is that right, Gary?
This is the third one that we've done. There was the first play we did about Machiavelli was called The Prince, for obvious reasons. Obvious to me, anyway. I think most people know, might associate Machiavelli with the book that he's most known for, which is The Prince, which is a sort of discourse on the ways and means of how a ruler in Renaissance Italy manages the intricacies of running a state and avoiding being murdered or having someone take your state away.
Usually those two things happen side by side.
Yeah.
Yes.
You need to be beloved and feared.
Yeah, well, interestingly, that's an interesting point that's often mentioned about Machiavelli. He takes in The Prince, he usually takes a question and then he sort of gives a pro and con kind of discursive response to it, which of course he's writing both sides of the argument, but he asks the question, is it better for a prince to be loved or feared? Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, it's nice to be loved because that will earn you the loyalty of your subjects, the people whom you rule over. But it's also very useful to be feared. And he says it's actually best to be both. But if you have to be one or the other, if you have to pick one or the other, Machiavelli says it's better to be feared.
Well, so then that was 2010.
Uh-huh.
And then in 2014, you wrote a prequel.
Yeah, well, the way it was pretty interesting, Greg's mentioned the Central Works method, which is a rigorous method of developing a play, which you, Patricia, have had some firsthand experience.
Yes,
of.
Indeed.
And it can be pretty scary, you know, essentially starting out with no play, introducing the actors to the idea and then developing the play when you're staring down the barrel of an opening night date a few months away, which is exactly what we did with the first Prince, the project. And I actually had the good fortune to travel to Italy and see a bunch of places that follow in the footsteps of the characters I had in mind for the play, and came back. We started the workshops, and there was 10 of them scheduled, and we had two wonderful actors, Michael Navarro and Richard Frederick, and Greg was there and Jan was there. And we worked on the script, which I thought I had a solid grasp of, but it involved two actors and three characters. As the number of workshops slowly clicked down to number 10, finally I remember arriving, I think it was at the last meeting, and having to face the cast as well as my other compatriots and say, guys, I'm sorry, but I got nothing. Which was a terrifying moment for all of us. I said I got nothing, but I think I might know a way out of it. And the problem that I had run into was, of the three characters, it was really like two plays were stuck together. And I realized there was no way to get all three characters in the one play, because they were two different stories that were really fighting against each other. So I selected the one that we did, but then I wanted to come back to the other play, which was a play between Niccolò or Machiavelli and Cesare Borgia, which was the second play we did. So that came a couple of years later.
Mm-hmm. That was The Lion and the Fox.
Yes, that's correct.
And the thing is that trying to let go of Cesare Borgia for the Prince was hard, because he's such a compelling and completely insane character. and I think that was part of the issue, that we didn't want to let him go because he was so compelling.
Mm-hmm. Now, both of those plays are dramas.
Mm-hmm.
And Mandragola is a comedy that takes place many years later, and it's got four actors instead of two. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
There's actually five plays in all.
Oh.
And we've done parts two and four. And Mandragola is part five. So you have it's five plays. This is only the third of them that we've done. But it ends with a comedy. So there's actually four dramas and one comedy.
Huh.
Treating really Machiavelli kind of in the course of his whole life. So the five plays altogether tell some approximation of the course of his career. And when Mandragola begins, he's kind of at the nadir of his career and he's getting old. And he is no longer able to work as a diplomat because he's been disgraced. And so he turns to writing comic plays, which is based on the real Machiavelli. He actually did this. And a lot of people don't know that Machiavelli was actually a very popular playwright. I would say the most popular playwright in Italy, but it's 50 years before Shakespeare's even stepped on the stage. So plays are quite new. In our play, plays are brand new. It's like television in the late 40s. It's this new form. There's a bit of a market for it, and so that's what Machiavelli, this political scientist, has been reduced to the lowly status of an itinerant playwright, really, which is something I can identify with. And he gets a big break to come present his new play, which is the play he actually wrote called Mandragola. And we know, what little we know about the first performance of the play, we know it was the first historical record is that in 1522 it was performed for a private audience in Florence, no doubt a wealthy private audience, at a place called the Rucellai Gardens, which was the home estate of a wealthy family patriarch at the time in the ruling class of Florence, which is no longer a republic, mm-hmm. which Machiavelli himself was very instrumental in establishing, and is really the cause of his exile. When the Republic was overthrown, he was booted out.
So when you say there are five plays, you've written five plays?
I have.
Yeah, wow. Okay, well, we want to see them.
There's two yet. Two we haven't done yet.
Uh-huh. So, Greg, let me ask you, you've designed sound for all three of the Machiavelli-inspired productions. And so can you talk about how you approach a script when you're doing sound design?
We were talking about this before we came on the microphone, about what process do I have? I mean, in a way, kind of in the same way that a script tells an actor where to go and kind of gives the clues forward, the script does the same thing to me, that I'll, mm-hmm. I'll sit down and read the script and just start scribbling things that I hear. I almost kind of do beat work sort of like an actor, and with that I identify sections or beats or things that might potentially merit some underscoring. I certainly take note of things that, you know, okay, obviously there's a sound that has to happen here. Obviously there's some uproar that's happening in the next room over. We'll need something for that. So I just kind of go through and do my homework, as it were. And then I'll meet with the director and go through and I'll say, I'm thinking this, this, and this. And the director will say, how about this or maybe that? And usually most of my comments at that point are underscored with multiple question marks, like, do we want something here? I don't know if we want something here. And then I'll come to what is called a designer run, where the actors are pretty much, are maybe off book, but there's the kind of the whole shape of the play is essentially there. And I'll sit and watch the play as an audience member. And I'll usually cross out around a third of the ideas that I had for my sound design. And then I'll add around twice as many more into the design, just because whatever the actors are doing kind of sparks the ideas, or certain moments seem to inspire either certain musical ideas or certain sonic ideas. And for this one, actually, I was thinking that Mandragola was going to be a fairly easy and small design, which of course I should know better by now. but we discovered that there was actually a lot more complex. It required something a lot more complicated than we had initially thought. And we had to go through and do an entire new recording session with the actors, which people who they come to see Mondragola will be able to see exactly what that is. It actually, in a way, makes it more fun for me to have more things to do as I'm operating the show. This one suddenly leapt up in levels of complexity, I think around 5 days before we opened, which is...
Whoa!
It's like, okay, I guess I'm going into the studio tonight.
Yeah, there's this very complex illusion we're trying to create during the performance of our play, which is that the first performance of Machiavelli's play, Mondragola, is actually being staged in a room adjacent to the room where the actors are. In other words, we're off stage and the play is being performed next door.
Mm-hmm.
And every time an actor comes in or goes out through one of the two doors that lead into the grand hall where the play is presumably being performed, according to the illusion we're trying to create, the sound of the performance swells through as the door opens and then diminishes as the door closes, but then faintly proceeds underneath, almost like an underscoring. And so we discovered that what we would have to do is actually record large sections, first fabricate the text for the play that was being performed, you know, the play that's being performed next door.
Machiavelli's play, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, which we downloaded from, you know, online and was Google translated and made from the Italian and made absolutely no sense at all. So it was a very quick rewrite of Machiavelli's sections, a few pages of Machiavelli's play, but it goes on for the whole, you know, the entire climactic sequence of the play. It's, I don't know, Greg, how long? 10, 15 minutes?
I mean, at least 15 minutes. The thing is that yeah. The audience reaction next door was in the script, so we knew we knew what the audience was thinking of the play, but we realized we were hearing the reaction, we're not hearing the play, and it just felt really weird to to hear one but not the other, and that's when we realized, we need the play, we need to hear the play. And I have to say, the recording session we did of them reading the Machiavelli play, Gary and I were very hard-pressed to keep from laughing throughout the entirety of the performance.
Well, it is a comedy.
It is a comedy, and the actors made it even more so.
Yeah, it was really an interesting sort of phenomenological experience, because you're at the end of the rehearsal period, and suddenly the actors are bringing to life a whole section of the play that we had no experience of.
It had been referred to a lot over the course, in the course of Gary's play, but we hadn't actually read the text.
So now we were watching the actors actually bring to life the play, and it was really fun experience. It was as if we had a whole new window into a section of the play that we hadn't seen before. It was really fun. Mm-hmm. It was really, and the actors were so funny in doing it, and they're supposed to be funny. And so it was really delightful.
Yeah, it was really delightful.
Cool.
And we hear it in performance too. We hear little traces of their rendition of the play off stage.
Well, it's interesting because this is like a play within a play, right?
Exactly.
So what's it like to write that? Since you're working the theater all the time anyway, and what kind of inspiration do you draw? Is this, you don't have to mention any names.
The names have been changed to protect the guilty.
Well, the actors in the play who are doing the play have been thrust into it on the day of the performance, unexpectedly, and two of the three of them have no experience as actors before, which presents an interesting opportunity to have the playwright, the character of Machiavelli, is instructing these
rank amateurs
who are actually, to be honest, gangsters, schooling them in how to perform a play before either of them has ever even seen a play. So it's a way of kind of abstracting the idea of play and the role of the playwright and the priorities of the playwright versus the experience of the actors. And so it really becomes kind of an analysis or an exploration of the very idea of what is a play. What are we really trying to do here?
Mm-hmm. But he also, I mean, it also gives Gary a perfect opportunity to kind of explore the really absurd language that theater people use, and that we yes. all take for granted, and that we don't realize mean it's absolute gibberish to anybody else. And so a lot of the fun of it is being able to explore the lingo, the language. I mean, Gary as a playwright is always very interested in lingo and terminology, and what do these types of people say, and what kinds of terminology do they use. And so it's fun to be able to explore that angle of lingo that we all take for granted.
Fantastic. Okay, well, I'm really looking forward to seeing it, and I want to invite all the Script Club listeners to come out to the Berkeley City Club between now and April 16th to see Mandragola. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much, Patricia. It's okay. been a pleasure.
Thanks for joining us for the Central Works Script Club. For more information about Mandragola at Central Works, to read the script, and to order tickets, visit centralworks.org. See you next time.